State, the Morning Show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. In part two of today's program, we're going to be talking about the current production of the Carthage College Theater Department, an original work called Afghanistan, Wisconsin, based on some of the experiences of Wisconsin veterans fighting in the war in Afghanistan. In part one of today's program, however, we're going to be taking a look at a very important event for opera fans all across the country, the opening of the 10th anniversary season of HD simulcasts from the Metropolitan Opera, which will begin with Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore. On today's program, we're going to hear, first of all, from an interview which dates from 10 years ago, right on the eve of the first HD simulcasts from the Metropolitan Opera. This is a conversation which I recorded with none other than General Director Peter Gelb, who is still the Artistic Director of the Metropolitan Opera, lo these 10 years later. So let's enjoy this interview from the archives with Peter Gelb, and then another special treat for opera fans right after that. This is the Morning Show on WGTD. These are spectacularly interesting times at the Metropolitan Opera, and America's greatest opera company is revitalized in all kinds of powerful ways under the leadership of its new general manager, Peter Gelb, who has helped initiate a number of different moves to make the Metropolitan Opera more present in our cultural landscape, more vividly present. And chief among those ways is a means by which the Met is sharing itself and its music making with the general public in a series of digital simulcasts in movie theaters across the country. And joining me for the next few minutes to talk about this very exciting reality, Peter Gelb, the new general manager of the Metropolitan Opera. Mr. Gelb, a welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
You have not been on the job very long at all, and yet here we are with all kinds of things already taking place. Tell us at what point in time you actually were able to begin the wheels turning to bring about some of these exciting innovations for the Met.
Well, I guess these initiatives are really representative of kind of a lifetime of work in the world of music. I was appointed to this position at the Metropolitan Opera in the fall of 2004. I only became the general manager officially on August 1st. But I've had a variety of different jobs during my career, including running a record label, and I've been a producer of television programs and films about music, including at one point on a freelance basis running the Metropolitan Opera's media department in the 80s, where I produced The Ring Cycle for PBS, amongst other projects. So, I guess in a way that was why the Metropolitan Opera board sought me out for this position, because they didn't want to hire a conventional opera director. They wanted somebody who would function more as a producer and who would be able to think of new ways to stimulate the public and the art form, because you know opera is not a young art form. It's an older one, and we have to sort of be extra vigilant to combat its aging.
Absolutely. So so obviously, you didn't just walk into the door on the 1st of August and begin work. I mean, you have already, in a sense, been working as general manager elect, I guess,
right,
of the Met. I mean, in order to make all this possible.
Right. There was a period of approximately 18 months of build up to my becoming the general manager. There was a 6 month period where I was a consultant. Then a year for which I was general elect. During that year, I worked on the renegotiation of various labor agreements with our unions to permit the high definition transmissions that we are talking about today, and amongst other electronic innovations that the Met's going to be partaking in this season and in future years.
It's fascinating what a different sort of public stance this is for the Met, in that the tradition long has been that the Met has been tremendously protective of itself and of its legacy, to the point of almost completely excluding cameras from inside the opera house. I mean, I can think of several different examples in which documentarians really had a door sort of summarily slammed in their faces because, no, we can't take a camera in here, and this can't be recorded, and this can't be broadcast. And you, in a sense, to a large extent, are throwing open the doors of the Metropolitan Opera. What do you think, most importantly, is accomplished by this new attitude of openness?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, the Met, it's not that the Met didn't want to be open. I just think it was probably too troublesome to be open to documentarians, as you put it. You're absolutely right. There were so many union rules and regulations that the Met was hamstrung by them. And quite frankly, for decades, publicity, marketing, advertising were things that the Met weren't required because everything sold out. So the reason why I'm undertaking all these initiatives of lifting this barrier between the Met and the broader public is because it's absolutely essential that a new public learn about opera and become interested in opera. But it all begins, really, with what we do on the stage itself. One of the most important initiatives I'm undertaking is to double the number of new productions at the Met, to invite the world's greatest theater directors to come and work at the Met, thereby creating productions here that actually demonstrate what opera is meant to be, which is this, when it works at its best, which is a sublimely satisfying art form that marries music and theater. Because after all, it's opera that preceded musicals, and it was originally intended by the great composers, whether Puccini, Verdi, Mozart, Wagner, whoever, to be a theatrical art form. So that's the main thrust of what I'm doing is on the one hand, respecting the musical values of the Met, the great traditions of the great orchestra of the Metropolitan Opera, the great casting that the Met has achieved over the years, but to up the ante, so to speak, artistically at the same time, so that it can appeal not only to the diehard aging audience, but also to a new audience.
So opera doesn't go the way of the butter churn.
Well, hopefully not. The wonderful thing about opera is that the geniuses who composed the operas that have lasted throughout time, at least the last few hundred years, their work is timeless, but it requires modern stage productions to excite the public, and that's why this season, for example, even though it was a season that was planned before I got here, I managed to make some changes and introduced a few new productions that hadn't been planned, like Anthony Minghella's the filmmaker Anthony Minghella's wonderful new Madame Butterfly that seemed to captivate audiences here. At the same time, we had on our opening night, we transmitted the opening night performance onto giant screens at Times Square, which the mayor of New York graciously agreed to close the traffic so that the real inner public of New York could enjoy this experience.
And I have to say, I greeted with great joy the news, although I don't know if this ultimately came to fruition or not, but that the Late Night with David Letterman show was going to show an excerpt from The Barber of Seville.
Yes, it was a live performance. The first time in the history of the Letterman show that a complete opera, not a whole opera, but a complete sequence of an aria, it wasn't an aria, it was actually the finale of the Act One. In a slightly cut down version, but we had crammed into that studio 22 orchestra members, a chorus of I think 16 in soldiers' uniforms, and our principal six cast members all lined up in front of standing microphones, but in full period costume.
And one has to hope that there will be many more such opportunities for regular folks to turn on the television and see something of the Met in those kind of accessible venues.
Well, we're hoping for that. But what's particularly exciting right now is these high definition transmissions, because this is a way, I think, to really both stimulate the huge public that we already have listening to the Met on Saturday afternoons on the radio, as well as invite a new public into local movie theaters where they can experience this live spectacle of opera on giant screens with surround sound. And really provide a kind of sense of artistic community locally would not have been possible. It's only possible now thanks to high-definition technology.
It occurs to me that this is in some ways sort of reminiscent of the good old days when the Met toured the country, and it was possible to experience the Met in a place like the Twin Cities, for instance, or Atlanta, Georgia. In a sense, this isn't exactly that, but it reminds us of that.
Well, certainly, I think one of the great advantages of the old Met days of the Met touring is that it further established a loyal national audience and constituents for the Met, and it's that loyal guard, that remains partly from the old touring days that we think is going to flock to the movie theaters along with new audiences as well.
Was this a difficult thing to sell to the movie theater firms that are cooperating with you? I mean, did they fairly quickly embrace this idea, or even understand this idea, this proposal?
The idea was embraced quite enthusiastically and quickly by the movie theater companies that are in this business, because they're very interested themselves in establishing alternative entertainment forms to movies. Now that they have high-definition technology exists and video images in high definition that are equal in picture quality to movies can be projected in movie theaters, it provides the possibility for movie theaters of offering not only the Metropolitan Opera, but other forms of entertainment live. In Canada, for example, our partner there, Cineplex, has been offering live wrestling in movie theaters. So it's now opera and wrestling in Canada. Have your pick. So the movie theaters actually are very excited about this, because they want to devise other means to entice audiences into their houses.
I can't let you go without asking two very quick questions, which I've heard from more than one person, different people excited about this first simulcast of The Magic Flute on December 30th. One person asked me, so do we get to eat popcorn? I mean, is it going to feel like we're at a film in that kind of respect? And the other thing is, at the end of this, are we supposed to applaud?
Well, I hope the answer to both of those is yes. I mean, I've never been inhibited from applauding in a movie theater when I liked a movie. It doesn't happen often, but it's happened sometimes. And certainly, if there's a great performance, which hopefully we'll be delivering, I would certainly encourage the audience to applaud, and I hope they will. As far as popcorn is concerned, I think that's part of the movie theater experience. Certainly the concessions in the movie theaters have not been told not to sell popcorn. It should be an interesting merger, cultural merger, of grand opera and popcorn.
That was Metropolitan Opera director Peter Gelb in a conversation from 10 years ago on the eve of the very first season of HD simulcasts from the Met. The 10th anniversary season of simulcasts begins this Saturday at 12 noon with Giuseppe Verdi's Il Trovatore. And of special note is that in the cast is Siberian baritone Dmitry Hvorostovsky. Earlier this year, Hvorostovsky, one of the greatest baritones in the world, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He has been undergoing chemotherapy in London, England, and responding very, very well. He interrupted his chemotherapy treatments in order to fly to the United States and to sing in three performances of Il Trovatore, the last of which will be Saturday afternoon's performance at the Met, which people can see in movie theaters across the country, including the Renaissance Theater in Racine and Tinseltown in Kenosha. I thought it was a good opportunity to turn to the archives and replay a portion of the conversation which I recorded some years ago with Dmitri Hvorostovsky, talking about his very impressive career. You seem like you're handling your career very wisely, making very sensible decisions about repertoire, about workload. How do you suppose that you're managing to do that when it seems like so many young singers do not handle their careers quite so carefully and cautiously?
Well, I've been taking my time, and when my career began, I was actually pushed to do too many of the dramatic roles. So I had to make a strong decision. I had to postpone it. I had to deny them. And then what I did instead, I did a lot of recitals where I proposed the many of Russian music and a lot of different programs. And in the very same way, I have done some of the operas where I could handle the heaviness of the music that's written for baritone, and gradually myself, along with my voice, being growing up and enlarged, and I'm pretty widely open to expand the repertoire in the opera field, and I do this, I'm very satisfied with what I have done, but in the beginning it was pretty tough for me, pretty tough.
I want to ask you about something that I read when Gramophone magazine interviewed you, I think it's maybe 2 or 3 years ago now, and you were talking about your career and the great strides you'd made, but you also made brief mention in that interview about how you sustained some temporary damage to your throat, to your voice. I think you said something about a severe coughing spell or something. I read that and I thought, my word, that must have been a frightening experience, and it's gratifying to see that you've made such a complete recovery. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, I hadn't even remember what I was talking about.
Yeah, right.
But the singers, unfortunately, they have to handle the severe illnesses, throat illnesses, because it's like our working muscles and always warmed up, always kind of warm and hot, and then you should take really great care of your throat. And having had such busy schedule, travel around the world, you're in such danger to catch any diseases, particularly when you travel in the plane. You have to somehow prevent any of some kind of disaster, because it is a disaster when you got sick and then you cannot sing well and you suffer out of it and still have to do this. And particularly when you're not in a good condition, when you feel when you have cold or the tracheitis or whatever, and you're still singing, it might cost you a lot of damage. So it's a tough career.
Yeah, and that's a fragile little thing in your throat, and
very precious.
I'm curious if you find yourself forming friendships with a lot of your fellow singers. I know that some opera singers do that, and others prefer to find their friendships away from the opera house. And I'm curious if who some of your favorite colleagues are, or singers maybe that you especially admire.
Well, I'm not considering myself as any kind of opera singer or star or somebody like famous. I'm a simple person. I'm very I like to communicate with people. I like people very much, and it doesn't matter for me who is this person, whether he's my colleague or a piano player or whoever. I mean, if I like someone, I like them.
I have to tell you about one of the most, I think the single most exciting thing I have heard from you was on one of the Richard Tucker Gala concerts on television, when you performed the aria from Il Trovatore, Il Balen, which is such a killer aria. I remember struggling with it as a young singer myself, and so I know something of your accomplishment in singing it so beautifully. And then at the end of it, you climbed up to this high A that I'd never heard anybody do anything quite like that. It's so exciting.
Edward Shaw.
Yeah. And I wondered, too, because a few minutes earlier, Cheryl Milnes himself had been on that same stage singing the prologue to Pagliacci and got loose with a high A-flat. It made me think that maybe this is part of kind of the healthy competition between great singers who sort of spur each other on to do greater and greater things.
Exactly. We were sharing the same dressing room as well.
Really? Really? And sharing stories, I suppose, huh?
Yeah. But he took much higher, man. He had they sent the finale of third act in from Ballo and Maschera, and he covered everybody by taking a high B flat in the end of finale. So actually, he got higher.
Oh, okay. Well, so he won the race, huh?
He won the race. Yeah.
That is Siberian baritone Dmitri Hvorostovsky. He made headlines earlier this year when he was diagnosed with a brain tumor, but has responded very well to chemotherapy, has interrupted his treatments to fly from London to New York City to sing in three performances of Verdi's Il Trovatore, the first of which was this past Friday night, and a triumphant success. The last of those three performances is this Saturday afternoon, which also marks the beginning of this 10th anniversary season of high-definition simulcasts from the Metropolitan Opera, broadcast to movie theaters across the country, including Tinseltown here in Kenosha and the Renaissance Theater in Racine. And you can go to metopera.org if you would like more information about Saturday afternoon simulcast, which begins at 12 noon and is just the first of 10 such simulcasts from the Met. Part two of the morning show coming up in just a moment here on WGTD. And now for part two of today's program here on WGTD. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios, a faculty colleague from Carthage, Martin McClendon from the theater department at Carthage, and joining him, Laurel McKenzie, who is a senior theater major and a history major as well. And she is the playwright for a brand new work which just premiered this past weekend and runs for the next two weekends as well at Carthage College. And it is a play called Afghanistan, Wisconsin, a verbatim theater project in which we experience a chronicle of what a number of different Wisconsin veterans have experienced in the war in Afghanistan. And we're going to be talking with Laurel about her encounters with some of these veterans and the experience of transmitting their experiences into the medium of a dramatic play. And Martin McClendon is the director of the production, and we will find out a bit from him about this production and about helping shepherd this brand new work to life. We welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thanks.
Good to have you here. Martin, maybe you could explain, first of all, the subtitle, which maybe people have noticed on posters and other publicity materials for Afghanistan, Wisconsin, this notion of verbatim theater. What does that refer to?
Sure. So verbatim theater, you know, the word verbatim denotes, you know, something that's sort of taken exactly from its source material, and that's kind of the motif for the play. So over the summer, Laurel and I interviewed a dozen veterans, and we recorded those conversations, and Laurel toiled away at transcribing those, and then those words became the play. So, you know, her playwriting skills in this case weren't at inventing anything, but at creatively sort of putting the building blocks together to make, you know, the storyline kind of come to life. You know, we did some editing in order to sort of move things around and make them make sense a little bit better. You know, take out some of the ums and pauses. But really, when the word verbatim here is sort of rings true, the whole evening is the words and experiences of these veterans put on stage and enacted.
When I saw that subtitle, I thought maybe I had missed an announcement about some kind of series, ongoing series at Carthage, and it doesn't really denote that, but I suppose it doesn't preclude the possibility of something like this happening again. Future verbatim projects.
I think the whole production team has been so affected by our work in the show. I can't imagine that we won't do this again, you know, with maybe another different story that needs to be told. But it's been a really rewarding experience. Mm-hmm.
So before we talk to Laurel about sort of her experience in actually directly encountering these veterans and shaping this script, Martin, maybe you could say a word about how this opportunity came her way, or did she come to you with offering this up as a possibility? I mean, what was the genesis of this?
Sure. Well, the every Carthage student in their senior year has a sort of a capstone project that they have to do to fulfill their major requirements. So Laurel was already sort of looking around for something to do. And at the same time, I had become interested in America's Longest War, which, you know, had just concluded that summer officially. Although we still have 10,000 troops there, and even this morning there was actually, you know, kinetic activity, as they say, in Afghanistan. But I started to realize that the veteran population, for me, you know, seemed sort of invisible. The sacrifices that they had made had not been acknowledged, I don't think, in the same way that maybe veterans from past conflicts had. It's sort of been a muted response. And so I started to look into that, and I realized that there are stories real close to home that we could tap into and maybe provide a service by raising some awareness, not only of the struggles of veterans, but also of their triumphs and of the things that they're, you know, the good experiences and the proud moments, as well as the moments of difficulty, to try to get a more full picture for this sort of monolithic group called veterans, you know. And one of the things that I think we've all discovered is, just like you and me, there's no such thing as the veterans. Every veteran is different. Every experience is different. And when you really take the time to get to know them, a whole new kind of vista opens up about who these folks are, what motivates them, and what more they could contribute if only we'd let them.
Mm. And, of course, something that is also true is that not only do veterans defy broad characterization and easy summation as a group, but also each generation of veterans in terms of what their own collective experience might be is really different. I mean, the experience of most World War II veterans is vastly different from that of Vietnam veterans or veterans of this latest conflict. And I think you're right that this most current generation of veterans, their stories are probably the least told or the most invisible to us in a lot of ways. So tell us how Laurel McKenzie became part of this effort.
Right. So I let her in on the secret that I was planning to do this in the spring before we announced it, and she eagerly took on the challenge. And then over the summer, we participated in the SURE program, Summer Undergraduate Research Experience, which Carthage subsidizes students to stay on campus and conduct research. Yeah, I'll turn it over to Laurel there and say, like, well, what did you do this? What did you do with your summer vacation, Laurel?
Well, essentially, what we did is that the first thing we had to do is get the transcripts, contact the veterans to get the interviews. And so the first month, June, and part of July was spent just sitting down with these veterans and having 2 or 3 hour interviews with them, either in person or over the phone. And then I would go home and transcribe it so that we would have the written their words written out to use to be able to start piecing this play together. And so that was probably the most time consuming part of it. But then as far as actually putting it together and finding the arc and the flow, Martin and I sat down and we just started cutting out stories, specific chunks of text that we felt like were really poignant or really just interesting or had to be, like, they were key core stories that had to be involved in this that we wanted to share with our audience. And so once we had that sorted out and divided into categories like deployment or enlistment or funny stories, coming home, I sat down and I took all those chunks and kind of organized it into what might be a play, might be some sort of dramatic arc, sort of. and then after that, I just printed it off, and Martin and I started doing the editing process from there, going through and trying to smooth it out into something that was even more sort of, I guess, thematic,
cohesive maybe, or,
yeah.
Which summer was this?
This past summer.
Oh, just now. So
right.
This
yeah.
really took shape in a hurry.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. We were committed to making this the first show of our season. And so we knew there was a time crunch. So contacting our vets, talking to them, and then doing all this work, there was a real, you know, there was some pressure on it.
Wow. So you were insane, in other words.
A little, yeah. Me not as much, because Laurel really shouldered that burden of doing the work, the clerical side of it, as well as then the creative side
wow.
of it.
I had no idea that this took shape so quickly. Laurel, ahead of this, was there anything in your past or your makeup or your interests that made you, in a sense, a logical choice to do this? I mean, for instance, did you have any background with veterans in your own family or your own history or anything like that, or not especially?
not especially. You know, my grandfather was in the Air Force, and that's about it for me. I guess what made me feel like I could really do this play justice, and I could be like a unique sort of resource, is the fact that I am a history major, and so I have I'm very comfortable with the research aspect of that, with being able to go in and look at something kind of objectively and parse out what's important, what isn't, and also just being able to kind of apply the truth that I found about the war and the conflict over there. So being able to understand that and apply that in a creative light, I think, was valuable. So.
Well, tell us about the process of actually connecting with these veterans and sitting down with them, I mean, in person in most cases, I guess, and having these interviews. First of all, was that process itself very complicated, or by and large, are there resources available that make connecting with veterans a relatively simple, straightforward matter?
Well, we'd never done this before, so we probably did it the wrong way. I don't know. But we learned as we went. And the first thing we did was just reach out to the Carthage community. And so we put an email blast out, you know, saying, you know, if you were involved in Operation Enduring Freedom, you know, or if you were in Afghanistan, then we'd like to talk to you. And almost immediately we got a couple of contacts from that. And especially the first person we talked to became kind of really central. Turned out to have some amazing experiences and also be very eloquent in talking about them. And from there, there was also one of our people who ended up being in the cast. He had several friends. He works with several vets. Oh. So those were some immediate contacts we had. From there, it was a little bit more of a struggle to try to reach out to the veteran community, mostly on a person-to-person basis. So, like, not reaching out to the VA, for instance, but just through various other sort of veteran-related blogs or websites and so forth. One of them's called Military Experience in the Arts. So I contacted them, and they gave me several contacts as well. It was a little harder to find women veterans, too. We had to work a little bit harder on that. But again, I probably didn't go about it the right way. There's probably a whole group of women veterans who would love to share and their experiences, but I just didn't get into contact with them. But in the end, the 12 people, I mean, we got plenty of material, you know. Mm-hmm. There's only so much you can do in a 2-hour play format. And in the end, you know, every one of those veterans was so incredibly giving of their time and so forthright in talking about their experiences. It was really amazing. I mean, if you want to segue into how those interviews were conducted and so forth. You know.
That's absolutely what I want to reintroduce you first. We're talking with Martin McClendon and Laurel McKenzie about a work which has just been created and just performed for the very first time anywhere this past weekend at Carthage College, a play called Afghanistan, Wisconsin, which chronicles various experiences of Wisconsin veterans in the war in Afghanistan. So about a dozen veterans you mm-hmm. sat down and talked with. Describe, first of all, your expectations and the planning you did ahead of each and every one of those interviews. Did you walk in, for instance, with a prepared set of questions and in a sense, an agenda that has such a negative connotation, doesn't it? But did you have a pretty specific idea of what you hoped to learn from each of these interviews?
I think so. We definitely sat down and talked about the questions that we wanted to ask. I had a very long Word document of pretty much any aspect that I could think of that would possibly encompass any part of their enlistment, training, deployment, coming home. That was very detailed. But when I went in there, I found that those questions weren't really necessary, and it was more just a conversation that could flow. The only thing that I remember really stressing in the interviews is asking kind of right off the bat, what if you could tell the general public anything about your experience, about who you are as a veteran, about what it means to you, what would that be? And some people were like, I'm sure something will come, but I don't know now. Mm. So let's just get to talking. But some people had something right off the bat that they wanted to say. And so that was really interesting, seeing maybe who had like really thought about this and had their words really there, and who just wanted to talk about, you know, their experiences and tell their stories. So,
How wide a range of age are we talking about?
Pretty wide.
Yeah. We had people who had deployed between like 2010 and 2013, and then our most senior veteran, let's put it that way. Dr. Graham, Dr. Karis Graham, she's a lifelong, you know, career military and reserve person. She's also a chaplain. She's one of the highest ranking female chaplains, one of the first women sent into combat during Gulf One. And so we were really, really fortunate to get to talk to her. And obviously she's older. She's winding down her military career at this point. So everywhere in between, basically.
Mm-hmm. I should think that one of the things you were most anxious to do is to gather what would amount to a fairly wide swath of experience. And the potential with, I mean, you spoke to 12 and you had plenty, but on the other hand, that's a very, very small right. number in the grand scheme of things. And with a little bad luck, you could have ended up with 12 embittered veterans or 12 veterans that thought everything was great or whatever. I mean, not had much of a representative sweep of the veterans' experience in the war in Afghanistan. I take it from some of what you've said that, in fact, you were fortunate and mm-hmm. that, in fact, what you were able to glean from these interviews was quite an impressive array of experiences.
Yeah, I mean, I think we were fortunate in pretty much every respect. We got, we have a chaplain, we have a number of infantrymen, we have some officers, and all the other veterans that serve not, you know, in the infantry. We have one from every branch. We have
except the Coast Guard.
But you know, yeah, we have a Navy man that we talk to, and we have all ages.
Both genders.
Pretty even split.
Did you do these interviews together?
For the most part, there was maybe one or two where you had to phone in.
Yes.
Or there was just one, I think
There's
we had to phone in. But other than that, yeah, we were always with the vets in the room. Mm. And I tried to let Laurel, you know, run the show, basically. But I sometimes just couldn't help myself. I would jump in with a question or whatever.
He's like that, isn't he?
Yeah.
That's too bad. Was it a difficult experience for any of these veterans? I mean, in terms of opening up and sharing frankly about their experiences, did you have to kind of cajole, or by and large, did they, in a sense, enter these interviews pretty much open from the first moment?
I think they were open. They knew, I think they were fairly aware of what they were getting themselves into. They knew they if they did this, they were going to talk about their experiences. And I think in almost every case, they ended up telling us things just kind of, and we didn't even realize this in some cases, these are things they had never told really anybody before. You know, this is something I've only shared with my husband, or this is something I haven't even shared with him. And so that was, sorry, I have a cold. that was really humbling to have them feel confident comfortable enough with us to do that. I think a couple of times we would hit on something that sounded kind of interesting and be like, do you want to tell us more about that? And they'd be like, no, sorry.
Yeah, there were still some things that they just were still processing maybe and not ready to share about. But really a remarkable amount of divulging. And again, not just all bad or stressful things, but good things too. But yeah, lots of, I think something about the format and about us being kind of strangers, you know, sometimes it's easier to open up to a stranger than it is to your family.
Interestingly enough. Yeah. And I suppose you assured them at least some level of anonymity. I mean, their
if
names.
If they wanted it, yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Several of them, you know, are acknowledged in our program, but several are anonymous mm-hmm. as well.
So let's talk about the process of shaping this into some kind of dramatic work. First of all, I think the point has been made pretty clearly that the editing of what they shared with you has been really kept to a minimum. Mm-hmm. To what extent have their words actually been altered in any way?
I mean, virtually no extent. Like, it's my understanding that if you watch this play and then went to the the tapes, which are going to be archived, hopefully, you would hear those exact same words. In some cases, we would add like a little sentence before the start of a monologue. You know, when I was in the Navy, blah 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 blah. We just to kind of like clarify things.
Yeah, yeah.
A couple of times to make the action more present on stage, I would switch the tenses that they were talking in to present tense as opposed to past tense. And sometimes, a lot of the times, we had a lot of content from some veterans that we really wanted to use, but we wanted to spread their load around among the cast. So we would reassign monologues or bits based on that.
Sometimes the actor or the character may be saying words that actually another veteran, one of them, that they're not playing, said, but we just had to switch it around because thematically it worked better. But we tried to do that as little as possible, and typically it's not jarring. It's not like, you know, you've got the infantryman suddenly saying something the chaplain said or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of thematically general enough in those cases.
Hmm. So how full was the wastebasket in terms of starting from scratch, rough draft number one, number two, number three, in terms of getting all of this information together and into something that flowed, that had some sense of arc, or did it take shape in a sense relatively effortlessly?
Effortlessly is not the right word. we had to scrap so many stories that were like, you know, that I wish we could still put it, like, I don't know. It's it was very difficult to say this story is going to get in and this story isn't. Because honestly, each one of these veterans supplied us with at least, you know, two to 3 hours of content. We could have written a play about each one of them individually. And it still is kind of difficult. There are still things, even as we're in our run, that is like, do we cut this? Do we try and continue to work on it? So Martin has been really helpful with that, with being that discerning eye for editing.
I'm trying, but you know, it's you really become attached to the stories, and
yeah. Sure.
And unfortunately, sometimes you have to cut those things in order to make it a stronger play. But there's so many stories, and we want to do justice to every one of the veterans, at least give them some of the spotlight.
It sounds like you also have endeavored to be as even-handed as possible, because certainly, now let's use the word agenda in a more negative connotation, it would certainly be possible, and probably many times before this, works like this have been put together, but really with an agenda in place or with a statement that the playwright or playwrights wanted to make about war as hell or whatever it might be. And the impression you're giving is that you really tried to enter this project and saw it to fruition without any predetermined statement that you were intended to make.
I really hope that we've achieved that. You know, our mission statement was that we wanted to give a voice to an untold story and that we wanted to foster better communication between the veteran and non-veteran communities, period. So there is no political agenda other than what the veterans themselves say. And there's one specifically that that touches on that. But I think the thing that really colors the whole piece, you know, that I've just started thinking about is that it's really it's a very small view, right? So people who are at that level of actually participating in these activities, they don't know the big picture. You know, they don't see the strategy. They don't see the political realms and everything. So there's very little of that. It's really mostly about these people struggling to do their best job that they can, you know, with whatever the job is, and coming up against, you know, personal barriers, coming up against, you know, physical barriers of just exhaustion or, you know, that kind of thing. So how they achieve their ends, how they complete their mission despite those obstacles, you know, kind of is really, to me, the story mm-hmm. of the play. And you can draw whatever political conclusion you want at the end of it about, you know, the war or our place in Afghanistan or whatever, but we don't make any statement about that.
I know that you extended a heartfelt invitation to any veterans who might be interested in coming to see this.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, I think that one of our vets specifically has told us that seeing the stories, you know, that he told us has a certain surreal effect, but I think that it also is a way to get those stories out. I mean, like, he doesn't have to tell people, you know, he can sit in an audience and watch people watching him up on stage, but he doesn't have to be there. Mm. And so again, it's almost like a filtering of the stories and bringing them back out, and hopefully fostering some better understanding.
Mm-hmm. We were just pulling up some numbers here that just here at Gateway Technical College, there are nearly 400 veterans enrolled. And once you figure in spouses and dependents, it's just under 500 members of the veteran community who are part of the student body here at Gateway. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that doesn't begin to show the totality of the veteran community here. And so you are inviting them to come and see this.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, we're going to be in our studio theater, which is a little bit more limited seating. That's October 2nd, 3rd, and 17th. And you can get in touch with our box office about that. But we would love to see vets there. You know, even though, you know, vets here are like a big group, and I'm assuming they have, you know, some kind of organizations or, you know, social media and so forth. But still, it can be an isolating experience, too, if you're the only vet in a class and nobody really understands what that's about. And so, again, this is a chance to come and see, like, oh, I'm not alone. Other people have had these experiences and are dealing with them, you know, too.
And say just a word about what this experience has been like for the students, the Carthage students that are in the cast.
Oh,
do you want to take that, Laurel?
I guess I can. I'm friends with them. I guess every single one of them has kind of had their eyes opened up to this experience. Some of the cast members are more already involved in this kind of community already. But some of them, you know, were kind of like me and didn't really have a contact or experience and didn't think about it that much. And now it's definitely on their mind. I know one of our cast members, one of our actresses, is actually kind of like almost becoming pen pals with her veteran contact, which is just really great because it's crossing generations, it's crossing these experiences, and I think it's really inspiring to all of us to be able to connect with these people, and not only as like a theatrical experience of connecting with the people that you're portraying, but just being able to, you know, reach out and share those stories and kind of, you know, look at them as role models in a way.
Hmm. So Afghanistan, Wisconsin is performed this coming weekend and the next, and also performances coming up on the 9th of November at the Kenosha Public Museum for Veterans Day. Mm-hmm. If people want more information or ticket information, what is it they do?
Contact our box office at theatertickets@carthage.edu, or also you can call 262-551-6661. You can also visit our website, and you'll see some links there to Afghanistan, Wisconsin, mm-hmm. on the Carthage Theater website and our Facebook page and all mm-hmm. the usual outlets like that. So we would love to see some folks from Gateway, veterans or non-veterans, come and share the experience with us.
Afghanistan, Wisconsin. And Martin McClendon is from the theater faculty at Carthage, and Laura McKenzie, the playwright responsible for this